Wherever people first came from, and there are many stories about that, in the beginning, human beings and gods lived in harmony. In a way, after all, both sides were descended from the same mother, Earth. In those early times, all enjoyed coming together and feasting. One day, their gathering place was set on Mykonei, not far from where Corinth is now. Prometheus was to make the meal. Now, this cousin of Zeus was an excellent butcher, but an inveterate trickster. On that day, he brought a big ox to cook. For Zeus and the other gods, he bundled up the ox flesh and the meaty parts in the animal's paunch to make it unattractive. For the humans, he laid out the white bones but nicely dressed them up in sleek, shining fat. Zeus took one look and said, with an edge to his voice, "It looks to me like an uneven split, my dear son of Iapetos." So Prometheus, in his twisty-minded way, smiled and said, "Zeus, almighty, glorious, ever-living God, pick the portion you want." Zeus had caught on already, but he played along. He took the glistening fat package, found it was only bones covered up, and exploded with anger. He had to live with his choice.
"Never without your tricks, Prometheus," said Zeus.
That was all. But Zeus got his revenge. He refused to give humans the fire they needed. Prometheus devised a plan. There is a plant that grows in marshy places called narthex, or fennel, tall like a bamboo, but with a whitish pith inside it, all the way down. Prometheus secretly made his way to Olympus, stole back fire from where Zeus had hidden it, and returned to the humans, with the flame safely smoldering inside the fennel stalk. Zeus went off to design something evil to pay them back.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. In this season, we're talking about guts. And I couldn't imagine a better way to start this season other than with Prometheus, the Titan hero who defied the Olympian gods by stealing fire for humankind and thereby altering forever humans' destiny. Well, today I'm sure you want to know with whom we'll be talking.
Our guest today is Richard Martin, one of today's foremost scholars of our time who has made significant contributions to the understanding and interpretation of mythological traditions. Before becoming Antony and Isabel Raubuchek Professor in Classics at Stanford in 2000, he was Professor of Classics for 18 years at Princeton University. Professor Martin graduated from Harvard University, where he received a Bachelor of Arts and AB in Classics and Celtic Literature, followed by an MA and PhD degrees in classical philology. His research centers on interpreting Greek poetry in the light of performance traditions and social practices. His primary interests are in Homeric epic, Greek comedy, mythology, and ancient religion. His research is further informed by comparative evidence ranging from fieldwork on oral traditions in contemporary Crete to studies in medieval Irish literature. Among his major publications are Healing, Sacrifice and Battle, Messenia and Related Concepts in Early Greek Poetry, The Language of Heroes, Speech and Performance in the Iliad, and Mythologizing Performance, published in 2020. In addition to several articles on Greek, Latin, and Irish literature, he's the author of publications for general audiences, such as Classical Mythology, The Basics, Bullfinches, Mythology, and Myths of the Ancient Greeks. An authority on Greek poetry and myth, he has produced an internet version of Homer's Odyssey with a team at Stanford.
Welcome, Professor Martin. What a fantastic opportunity to have you here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thinking about my questions, I thought about historical characters like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar, legends in their own right, whose historical aura has become almost mythical. And then at the same time, I thought about Achilles or other characters, mostly biblical, who might never have existed in real life, but do exist in the collective consciousness through storytelling. And I was caught in the dilemma of a world of in-betweens, of intertwined dimensions of fiction and reality. And I also thought about Herodotus, the father of history, and the way he started writing history with narratives that sway back and forth from historical facts to stories that could be perceived as fantasy. I guess what I want to ask you is plain and simple. Professor Martin, what is a myth and what are myths for?
Well, that's a really important question, and I wish I knew the answer, but I think the closest we can get is by saying myths are first and all stories. And they're stories that have an importance to some sort of collectivity. I like your phrase, collective consciousness. So it's hard to have an individual myth. But when you have more than one person believing in the existence of Achilles, for example, things begin to build. And you end up with a story that explains and helps human life. So I think their myths exist in many forms. You might not call them all myths. Sometimes it's advertising. Sometimes it's propaganda. But these are narratives that help you get along.
And talking about building up, now, regarding the origin of myths, from all the sources of Greek mythology, which you brilliantly summon in the introduction of your book, Myths of the Ancient Greeks, such as writings in the ancient Greek or Latin, like the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Theogony, as well as Herodotus' writings, and then you mention also lyrics, songs, and choral performances, poetry, the tragedians, and in addition, the artistic tradition of vase painting. On all of these pieces, or when all of these begin to gather into a puzzle of a picture that tells us a story. But then I ask myself, what story? Because we know that stories change, as you mentioned. It's not just an individual story, but as a building up of different stories. So they change depending on the time they're told also, and of course, on who tells them. And I want to ask you two things, Professor. First, are myths part of every culture? And second, could the way a myth is told help us understand the system of values and beliefs of a particular culture?
Oh. To start with the first question, I believe myths are part of every culture. The culture itself might not recognize it in terms that we apply to myth. When we say myth, often is used as a kind of contrast for reality or truth or history. So other cultures have different arrangements of their terms for these things. And think even in English-speaking cultures where we say myth is different from legend, is different from folktale. We try to make these distinctions. But I'm pretty sure there's no culture without a similar category. And as for the second question, myths, you know, in terms of how they express the culture are rather tricky things because, as you point out, they can change. I can tell you a version today of the Prometheus myth that might not be the one that I would have told 2 years ago if I'm living in ancient Greece around 800 BC. And This is because myths are primarily a product of an oral traditional culture. Even the word myth, which we get from ancient Greek, originally the word mythos, M-U-T-H-O-S, means something like an utterance, a story told. It doesn't necessarily imply truth or fiction, but it's a performance. And that's where I get particularly interested in myths as something that can shift depending on your audience. So if you're talking to the kings, you might want to emphasize in the story how Zeus, the ultimate king of the gods, is right in everything that he does. On the other hand, if you're talking to a bunch of commoners, you probably would emphasize the role of, well, let's say Prometheus, the one who opposes himself to the king. So in this way, you get many, many different versions of any individual myth, and there's never just one way of telling the story. As for the cultural value within it, if you were to accumulate all of these myths, and I'm thinking of the way that the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss worked with myths from an Amazon culture, the Bororo, you might be able to see patterns emerge. And I think you can do that with Greek myth. In terms of the largest possible categories, like the relationship between nature and culture, or the divinities and mortals. So it takes some teasing out, which is why we have people who study myths professionally. It's not always on the surface.
In the introduction to this podcast, we heard an excerpt of an interpretation of the myth of Prometheus taken from your book, Myths of the Ancient Greeks, which we just mentioned and which will be our guide throughout this episode. And following, we will hear another excerpt from this book regarding Prometheus and the creation of human beings.
Some say that Prometheus, the forethinker, first created human beings while he was experimenting one day with clay and water. Like a potter, he kneaded the earth and built up his creation. He fired these clay models with life and let the newly made men and women go forth on their own. But he was looking after them, even though the Olympian gods could not be bothered much about humans.
So let's talk about the power to create and the ability to transform matter. And we were mentioning these nuances, the differences in the approach that storytellers take when telling a story, depending on their perspective and also in a social dimension. And Prometheus is established as mankind's benevolent benefactor through the giving of fire, representing the ability to cultivate and pursue knowledge. But, and please correct me if I'm wrong, in neither of the texts of Hesiod nor from dramaturg Aeschylus, Prometheus is responsible for the creation of humans. And this act remains either unexplained or is completed by other gods.
You're exactly right.
And it is later that we begin to see references to Prometheus as the creator of men. And what I've noticed is that throughout the Roman Empire, the myth of Prometheus as a creator of humans is incredibly popular. So my question is, how should we interpret the Greeks conceiving Prometheus as benefactor of humankind versus the Romans, who in addition saw him as creator? In any case, why was Prometheus in and outside the Hellenistic world so fond of humans?
I think it's still something of a puzzle, because in the sources that you mention, Hesiod, who's a poet from around maybe 700 BC, and Aeschylus, a dramatist from the early and middle 5th century BC, we don't have any motivation. And we don't get that key fact that it was Prometheus, in some versions, who actually created humans. We tend, I think, to see ancient Greek versions through the lens of the biblical narrative of Genesis, where the Almighty God creates human beings as an act of love and will out of mud or dust, sort of like Prometheus with his clay, And there's motivation there. But puzzlingly, in the Greek version, we never hear why he does it. It's as if it's a sort of jeu d'esprit. He just is playing around. It's hard to say that he even animates them. And I think part of this is the mirage that's caused by the purposes of Hesiod and Aeschylus. Both of them want to focus on a kind of competition between this particular divinity, and after all, he's the first cousin of Zeus, and his much more powerful cousin. So it's a showdown in both Hesiod and in Aeschylus. And there doesn't seem to be any room for the idea that Prometheus might have created human beings, and that that's why he wants to give them fire. If I can just recall one of the details in the Hesiod version, Prometheus is a trickster. He's like that universal folklore figure, spider in Africa, coyote in Native American myth, Maui in Hawaii. These are all trickster figures. And his trick is to deceive Zeus. So you could say he started this all. There's a sacrifice in the days when human beings and gods all ate together. Prometheus disguises the good part of the meat in an ugly looking cover, and he puts the bones inside a very attractive cover. And Zeus, even though he knows what's happening, picks the quote unquote wrong sacrificial portion and then gets angry and then takes fire away from humans. And that's why Prometheus goes and steals it back. And the punchline, of course, of that story is that Zeus then doesn't steal it again from humans. Instead, he sends the very first woman, Pandora. So in Hesiod, it's this kind of tit-for-tat contest. In Aeschylus, it's a kind of rebel against the chief god, and there just isn't room to tell the creation story. I wonder, in that the contrast you mentioned between Greece and Rome, which I hadn't really thought about before, so thank you. I think the Romans, in a way, have solved the power problem, because they're not living in a system of 800 different city-states where there's questions of who's going to be the monarch or who's going to be the tyrant. They've got that settled. So they can use their mental energy, as it were, thinking more about anthropological questions. Where do humans come from? And let's remember that they are great brick makers, road makers, engineers. They're focused on creativity in the technological sense. So that might explain part of the contrast.
Yeah, what a great explanation. Them being also able to create and to founder construction along with their hands and transform matter for that means. Professor, you were talking about these parallels and how we see things through the lenses of our mindset. And you mentioned the Genesis. Also, this other part of the story in which Pandora is considered the first being of another race, a woman that is created by Zeus. We will hear another excerpt of your book, Myths of the Ancient Greeks.
He had Hephaestus make out of clay a figure that looked like a bashful human maiden with a human voice and looks that would rival those of a goddess. Athena dressed her in a silvery gown, adorned her with jewelry, and on her head placed an intricately worked veil topped with a crown of lovely blossoms. Aphrodite gave the maiden grace and charm, the kind that leads to melting desire and wrenching heartache. The graces and seasons and persuasion joined in, and Hermes he ordered to make her thieving and shameless, and named her as well. Pandora. Pandora was made to bring men pain. Some say she was the first woman. Zeus ordered Hermes to bring this lovely present to Epimetheus, the less bright brother, aptly named Afterthinker. Epimetheus had been specifically warned by Prometheus, "Don't accept any gifts from Zeus. Send them back, or something awful will happen." But when he saw the lovely Pandora on his doorstep, he forgot all that and took her in. Only when the harm was eventually done did he remember. all during the time when gods and men dwelled in harmony and enjoyed shared feasts, humans lived on the earth without experience of labor or any evil or killing disease. But then Pandora came, and with her she brought a big jar like the kind women use in the storeroom to keep grain or oil. One day, she lifted the lid. Out flew disaster, voiceless sicknesses that haunt the night, and 10,000 other ills. The sky and sea became filled with them. Pandora tried to reseal the jar again, but not until everything had escaped. All, that is, except for Hope, which, being small, could not manage to get past the lip of the container.
The interpretation that hope will always be there, no matter what kinds of disasters befall mankind, sounds to me too easy. What is your interpretation of hope being the one creature left on the jar?
Well, as I said, these texts are tricky, as if myths don't want to be revealed, and I agree that it's too easy to just say, oh, we'll always have hope. What was hope doing in the jar in the first place? For that matter, notice how we have two jars, as it were, and there is a person being formed out of clay, only Prometheus is not doing the forming. It's Hephaestus at the will of the gods, and this particular container, Pandora, contains all gifts. That's what her name means. And then she brings with her another jar, another clay-manufactured thing, like her double, and it contains all evils. And we're told that the things in the jar are disease and death and illness and hope. So what's hope doing there in the first place? It sounds like it's an evil, right? So in a way, it's a good thing that it doesn't get out into the world. It's still in the jar. So you can read it precisely both ways. Oh, it's in the jar. We'll always have hope. But it's in the jar. It must be an evil thing.
Like a deceiving concept, maybe.
And Pandora herself is this deceptive thing. It looks like a beautiful woman. He calls it kalon kakon, which means beautiful bad. Oh. Beautiful bad thing.
And in your opinion, what was the message back then that despite being dressed up with so many wonderful gifts by the gods and goddesses, Zeus' main intention to ask Pandora to be created and that he asked to create a woman, that this intention was to utilize this being or her to bring despair?
Precisely. She's a poison pill. It looks like a good thing on the outside, but this is his way of getting back at Prometheus. And he doesn't care about the universe of human beings. This is one of the disturbing things about the Greek gods. They live forever. They have no idea what death is. So he sends down this kind of weapon, Pandora, and she's not responsible for releasing the evils totally. It's Prometheus's dumber brother, Epimetheus, who welcomes her into his house. So you could say, well, humans brought it on themselves. The interesting notion, one of many behind this whole idea of Pandora, is that she is a different race. It's like women come from Mars or from Olympus, and you can't trust them. And that builds into a certain strain of ancient Greek thought, which we would say is misogynistic. But at the same time, it has to do in the poetry of Hesiod with the human condition, which is to say people live and die. They have to grow crops. They have to have a helpmate. They have to have a family. And so, as another Greek author puts it more comically, you can't live with them, you can't live without them. Women are part of the human condition, and it's the human condition that's problematic, not necessarily woman.
Yeah, and you're mentioning accountability, and I noticed that Pandora's curiosity seems to have to do more with a sort of naivete, with ingenuity, which is completely different to Prometheus' inquisitive and intelligent character that longs for and appreciates intellectual knowledge. Isn't so? And why is that?
Well, I think you put your finger on the difference between a trickster figure and the woman who you could say she's exploring her own nature because she, you know, she was crafted. She's created. She's like a big pot, as I said. And by opening the other pot, it's a kind of getting at the self. And then, of course, she finds out that the other pot, remember, it was a big jar. It wasn't Pandora's box. That's a misinterpretation from the Middle Ages. But this other box turns out to not be very helpful. It's full of things that, unlike Pandora herself. So the nature of Prometheus, I think you're right, you get by contrast with the nature of Pandora. He's somebody like the many trickster figures who just constantly is moving fast and breaking things, as we say in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and he knows what he's doing versus Pandora, who's just, as you said, just exploring like a kid, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, he knows precisely, so much so that in the play by Aeschylus, which I just reread in Greek and remembered how powerful it is, he's got this secret and he knows exactly how Zeus is going to be threatened. And here's what drives Zeus crazy, that Prometheus won't divulge the secret as to how Zeus is going to be overthrown someday. And that's why he pins him in the Caucasus and eventually buries him under a big mountain. And after that, he will sort of be extracted and tortured with the eagle eating his liver. So it's Zeus is going crazy because Prometheus does know too much.
The late Robert Bella, one of the leading sociologists of our time, defines religion as our human response to being alive and having to die. A set of symbolic forms and acts that relate man to the ultimate condition of his existence. In many respects, I thought this definition could certainly be also applied to myths. And we see how Christian iconography depicts the absorption of myths in Christian dogmas and narrative. How do this process begins to happen, and how do myths end up turning into religion?
This is a really big set of questions, and I would acknowledge, first of all, that myth does do a lot of the work of religion. And the thing we have to remember about Greek myth is that it's a strange combination from our point of view of belief and ritual and entertainment. So you tell stories about the gods and all of their doings and humans and heroes. But at the same time, you know, the next morning you wake up and you go and you sacrifice a lamb at the altar of the gods. So it's taken seriously at the same time as it's sort of entertaining. I think that's why it's hard for us to grasp as religion, but it is basically a part of ancient religion. And religion and myth both give you this totalizing worldview. Now, as for the Christian pagan interface, I wish we knew a lot more about that period. What we can say is that the earliest Christian writers were thoroughly conversant with Greek myth or with Roman versions of that. And someone like Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, the Christian father from North Africa who's living around 200 or so AD, actually mentions Prometheus. And he does it in an interesting way. He says, well, you know, they say Prometheus formed people out of mud, but our God was the first to do that. The true God, Verus Deus, is the one who was the first Prometheus. So they're trying to acknowledge that a lot of the people they want to convert have this other totalizing system, and they bring it into coordination with the new kid on the block, the new religion, Christianity. It's not a case. Yeah, I mean, it's not a clash.
A sort of reference points, right? Is that what it is?
Exactly, yeah. So you work, as any teacher knows, from what is already known to the unknown. So they start with the known Greek gods, and they sort of work towards monotheism. There are so many different twists and turns to that story that I could go on and on, but I'll give you just one other example. The ancient Greek word for a minor divinity, or when you want to talk about a god and you don't want to mention his or her name, is daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N. In the course of Christianizing, that becomes demon. So the minor Greek gods are dismissed as sort of fake gods. They're daimones in the sense of demons.
And continuing with Robert Bellah and religion, Bellah identifies a range of cultural capacities whose emergence made religious development possible. These being, for example, communal dancing and storytelling and theorizing. Now, our ancestors in the ancient world were able to give a transcendent meaning of their everyday struggles through a parallel reality offered by myths. And theater seemed to have provided them, as you were mentioning, with the perfect means to be swept away to other dimension. The role of play, specifically performance, and this includes rituals, I suppose, seems to have worked as a sort of a bridge that binds myth with religion. Professor Martin, what was the importance of performances in the process of myths developing into religion, and what role did muses play in it?
Performance, I think, is a really important term, and it does cover, as you say, ritual. It covers oratory. It covers the sort of thing you would say in the assembly in Athens. All of these are, to use a term that I use to define myths sometimes, authoritative utterances. They're things done by people who have some sort of knowledge or power in front of audiences. Those are the key factors. When you come to drama specifically, this is under the realm of a particular god, and it seems to develop, as Aristotle already pointed out, from festivals connected to Dionysus, the god of wine and growth. He's also the god of ecstasy, and literally, ecstasy is ecstasis, standing outside yourself. So when you put on a mask and you become another character in Greek drama, that's a form, literally, of standing outside yourself. And it seems that performances of all sorts provide cultures with this imaginative space where you can become another or the other. You can have men playing the role of women. In fact, there were no female actresses. They were always men. And the unresolved question is still being debated every year is to what extent, when Greeks went to say, the latest tragedy by Sophocles, they were involved in a religious event. Was it like a liturgy? Was it like a mass? Or was it pure entertainment? So we keep circling back to this paradox that for us, entertainment and religion are opposite sides of the spectrum. For them, they're one thing.
My second question was about the role of muses. What role did muses play in these performances, Professor?
Well, because, as you say, performance is so crucial, the muses represent, I guess you would say, the urge to perform. It's not accidental that our word music comes directly from musike, which is what the muses do. And it's not just playing or singing. It is acting. It's composing history. It's a realm of performance arts, if you like. The genealogy of the muses is important mythically. Their mother, you remember, is named Mosune, which means memory, and their father is Zeus. And again, to go back to Hesiod's poem from around 700 BC, the Theogony, the very first thing that the muses do, it seems, every day is to troop over to Zeus's house and sing in praise of Zeus. So from the standpoint of authorities, they're this great kind of propaganda machine. They spread the word of how the reality of the gods is most important. They really are good daughters of Zeus, but they're also daughters of memory. And every one of these performance arts is a matter of bringing back to life something that was experienced in a culture where you didn't have writing. That's the other important thing. Until around 700 BC, writing was not commonly used at all. And so whatever you had was in memory. You couldn't go to a library and look stuff up.
And so muses were a kind of source that justified where did something came from at the performance itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could. Well, when you start, you know, singing an epic poem like the poems of Homer, you call on the muses. It's like you're tapping into the cloud in modern data terms, they've got all of that data in their heads, and you beseech them to tell you the story as well.
Well, we will hear internationally acclaimed poet and president emerita of Penn International, Jennifer Clement, refer to the visits that perhaps muses pay her when writing poetry.
There's something that we could call your voice, or you could call it the gift, or you could call it talent. I mean, there's something there that's mysterious, or a personal gift of some mysterious kind. Or it could be the muse, is what people used to think it was, that you were visited actually by a muse, and she inspired you and made it happen. We don't think about the muse anymore, but maybe it's a muse.
Professor, coming back to storytelling and myths being composed and transmitted primarily within performances, what was the role of musicians and singers in poetry during these performances? And how was poetry different than of what we recognize as poetry today?
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction. We call poetry generally things that we read, although there's always, you know, poetry readings and poetry slams where you have people performing live with an audience against one another. That's a very Greek kind of thing. But if you think of another word for poetry, which is a lyric or lyrisches in modern European languages, that comes from the Greek word for a musical instrument, the lyre. So poetry and song were to most indistinguishable. Now, it could be that the person who composed the poems, let's say Sappho, herself sang to the accompaniment of a lyre that she played. Or there are different performance possibilities. It could be that she sang while somebody else played, but music was always around. Even in epic poems, and you know, the Iliad is 15,000 lines, the Odyssey is 12,000 lines, the way they were performed, at least as it's represented in the epics themselves, is to musical accompaniment. And if you look comparatively across the world these days, that still happens. You have long, long narrative poems in West Africa, in Central Asia, in the former Yugoslavia, where people play an instrument as they sort of recite. It's between song and speech. So the muses, you can see why musique comes from the muses. They're deeply involved with things other than mere recitation.
And following with performances, Professor, you were mentioning when Greeks were putting a mask in front of them, that they were able to stand outside themselves. And you're not going to believe that, but we're going to listen now to today's most celebrated mezzo-soprano, Marina Viotti, talk about how she transforms into the character she performs. And afterwards, we will hear her sing an excerpt of the most famous aria of Gounod's opera Sappho, O My Immortal Lyre, accompanied by Le Talent Lyrique, directed by Christophe Rousset. The complete version of this aria is part of the album A Tribute to Pauline Biardot, available to the audience all over the internet in the platform of your choice. Let's listen.
Well, when I sing opera, I am a character. I'm part of a story. I'm part of a vision. And so I'm not Marina. Just before I enter the stage, I kind of imagine myself the whole backstory of a character, how she will walk, how she will react. Is she naive or strong or soft? When I am on stage, I forget everything about myself, about me. And I am this character in this story, and I am delivering a text and an emotion. And so I kind of transcend the person I am and become this ambassador or this vector of kind of a higher purpose, or at least something that will reach people's hearts.
In the third act of Sappho Betrayed, Phaon awaits the other conspirators. Joined by the others, they bid a sad farewell to their country. Sappho arrives but remains hidden. Glycere asks Phaon whether he still loves her rival. He curses Sappho, who faints, The voices of the conspirators fade away as they board the ship, until only a goatherd is heard coming to her senses. Sappho sings, and unwilling to live without Phaon, hurls herself into the sea.
I mean, that was what we were talking about being swept away to another dimension. And we were talking about the importance of the social dimension in the developing of a myth and how ancient Greek theater was by no means mere entertainment. And dramaturg Aeschylus certainly brought the drama of classical Athens to another level with costumes, performances, music, and all what pertains to theater. We have come to the end of the first of the two parts of this episode dedicated to the myth of Prometheus. Professor Martin, thank you very much. Next time, we will be talking about the liver, the eagle that devours, sacrifice, and the challenges presented by today's Prometheus, and much more.
Thank you very much. It's been really stimulating.
To our audience, thank you too, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button.